Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hi, I'm Una Chaplin, and I'm the host of a new podcast called Hollywood Exiles. It tells the story of how my grandfather, Charlie Chaplin, and many others were caught up in a campaign to root out communism in Hollywood. Hollywood Exiles, from CBC Podcasts and the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and at 1400 GMT on Wednesday, the 24th of January, these are our main stories. A Russian military transport plane has crashed near the border with Ukraine. All on board are dead. Donald Trump takes a big step towards another run at the White House, but the contest to be the Republican candidate continues. And Thailand's opposition leader can take his seat in Parliament after being cleared of breaking election law. Also to come in this podcast, mass protests are expected in Argentina over radical plans to shake up the country's economy.
Every day we think about whether we're going to be able to pay the rent, whether we're going to be able to pay the building service charge, the bills.
We're going to start, though, in Russia, where, as we record this podcast, there are reports that a military transport plane carrying dozens of Ukrainian prisoners of war has crashed. The BBC has seen and has been able to verify footage of a plane crashing in a fireball in the southern Belgorod region. There's no independent confirmation, though, of why it came down or who was on board. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg gave this update to Sarah Montague.
Early this morning, about 11 o'clock local time, a Russian military transport plane, an Ilyushin 76, crashed in Russia's Belgorod region. Belgorod is one of those Russian regions that borders Ukraine. And very soon after, some mobile phone footage emerged, shot at a distance, showing the aircraft falling from the sky and then this giant fireball rising from the crash site. After that, the Russian Defense Ministry said that on board the plane were 74 people, including 65 Ukrainian prisoners of war, who Moscow says were due to have been part of a prisoner swap later today. We cannot independently confirm that. But interestingly, later in the Russian Parliament, the head of the Russian Parliament's Defense Committee, Andrei Kartopolov, he made a statement and claimed that there'd been a second plane in the sky at the time with another 80 Ukrainian prisoners of war who were due to take part in the swap. That plane, he said, turned around after the crash. Now, this is what Moscow is saying. The local governor in Belgorod says there were no survivors and that an investigation has begun. But Moscow has been making it clear that, as far as it's concerned, Ukraine shot the plane down. The Russian Defense Ministry claims that it observed the launch of two Ukrainian missiles. This is all coming from Russian officials, I should stress. We have no way right now of confirming all of this. But certainly the official position of Moscow is this was a terrorist attack, the Defense Ministry is calling it, by Ukraine.
And Ukraine, have they said anything about this?
As far as I know, and I'm sitting in Moscow, of course, but Ukrainian officials have said they're trying to clarify the situation. We know no more than that as of now.
Steve Rosenberg talking to Sarah Montague. Now, Donald Trump is one big step closer to another run for the White House. The former president won the New Hampshire primary overnight, the second of the state-by-state contests where voters choose who they want to be the Republican Party's candidate for the presidential election in November. He got around 54% of the votes. The only other candidate left in the race, Nikki Haley, got around 43%. It's the second of these votes that he's won in a matter of days after taking Iowa last week. It is unheard of for the contest to be this one-sided so early on, but it's not over yet. Nikki Haley is fighting on. We'll get some analysis of that in a minute, but first let's hear from candidates and the voters in New Hampshire, that small state tucked up in America's northeast, from where our correspondent Nomia Iqbal reports.
Well, I want to thank everybody. This is a fantastic state.
It was an election result Donald Trump accepted.
You know, we won New Hampshire three times now, three.
New Hampshire gave him a big win, but not a blowout, leaving his rival Nikki Haley still on for the fight to secure the Republican Party's presidential nomination.
This race is far from over. There are dozens of states left to go.
That was a comment Donald Trump really didn't like.
Let's not have somebody take a victory when she had a very bad night. She didn't win, she lost.
The race to win New Hampshire was seen as a real test for Trump's strength.
Hi, thanks for coming out. If you're all registered already.
Nearly 40% of people here are independent voters.
Even before you get inside to the polling station, there are about a dozen people outside all waving different signs for Donald Trump, Nikki Haley, Joe Biden. So they're really letting voters know how they feel as people drive in.
Amongst the group is Glenn, who arrived early carrying a cartoon picture of Trump wearing a crown with the words, "Live free, not under a king."
New Hampshire is one of the 13 original colonies. My ancestors threw off tyranny, King George II and the Third. Excuse me for saying that. And,
you're allowed.
And, you know, we're very sensitive to the constitutional rights and Bill of Rights. And I think that Donald Trump has trashed those things.
But Sue, with her many Trump signs, is no fan of Nikki Haley. She thinks she'd be nowhere without Trump, who once appointed her UN ambassador.
There is something to be said for loyalty. That I
You don't see Nikki Haley as loyal?
I don't. And I don't want any more never-Trumpers. Give him a shot. Give him the second term that he deserved, frankly.
Sue and Glenn, two very different opinions, two very different votes, but still friendly neighbours standing side by side in the snow.
I even made him hot chocolate.
Yes, she did. She brought hot chocolate for me, for David, and for others. Yeah.
Voters in New Hampshire play an outsized role in deciding presidential nominees. That's despite it being one of the smallest states in the country. Unlike the Iowa caucus, people have turned up at polling stations at any time during the day to vote. Mark is a registered Republican voting for Nikki Haley.
If Trump were to win, I would be worried for the future of the nation.
Would you vote for Biden?
Yes, I would. Yep, I would vote for Biden.
Dan has lived here his whole life.
I wouldn't say that if New Hampshire goes for Trump that the election's a done deal.
It's been nearly a decade of the Donald Trump era, so his path to the Republican presidential nomination was always likely. But to continue all the way to the White House, he'll likely face President Joe Biden, the man who beat him at the ballot box 4 years ago.
Nomia Iqbal. So, what does it all mean? Is this the start of a very long, and this could be very long, 10-month election campaign between Trump and Biden? Well, our other North America correspondent, Gary O'Donoghue, who's also in New Hampshire, spoke to my colleague Justin Webb, and he began by assessing how it went for Donald Trump.
The speech tonight was extraordinary. I mean, if you contrast what he said tonight to what he said after the Iowa caucuses last week, where it was all about bringing the party together, etc., he was full of venom and caustic comments tonight, swearing on primetime television as well, as suggesting Nikki Haley was an imposter. I mean, he was furious, frankly, that she was staying in the race, and he paraded some of the people who had dropped out and were now supporting him in a rather sort of embarrassing way. He doesn't like it one bit that she's fighting on. He doesn't understand it. And I think it's a strange strategy, because not only did he insult her, he insulted the kind of moderate, undeclared so-called voters in New Hampshire, many of whom are Republicans, by the way, and many of whom will, you know, presumably be voting in the general election later this year. This is a purple state. It's only four electoral votes. But if it's tight, it's not worth being rude to those people you might need later on.
And a final brief thought about the general election. Joe Biden is also going to be there, so he tells us. And it is an election, frankly speaking, isn't it, that most Americans, or many Americans, just don't want.
Vast majority don't want this matchup. You know, Joe Biden will be 81, Donald Trump will be 78. I mean, most Americans don't want this, and most people in both parties don't want this. It's an extraordinary position, and it's going to be a very, very long campaign. We know the Democrats are going to focus on the threat to democracy and abortion, and Donald Trump's going to focus on immigration, and they're going to be slugging it out in personal terms for the next, where are we, 10 months?
10 months. Get ready for it. That was Gary O'Donoghue, who was speaking to my colleague Justin Webb. And you can hear more about Donald Trump's presidential campaign team on the latest edition of the Global Story podcast. It's called Meet Trump's New Inner Circle, and it's from the BBC World Service. Right, let's move on, because Gaza's Hamas-run health ministry says more than 200 Palestinians have been killed in the past 24 hours amid some of the heaviest fighting yet seen in the ongoing campaign. Israel's military says it's killed numerous squads of Palestinian gunmen. Fresh evacuation orders have been issued for areas of Khan Yunis. That's the biggest city in the south of Gaza. Our correspondent in Jerusalem is Yolande Nil.
There's a route out to the south, although many people are very frightened to take it. Israeli forces have now issued evacuation orders for new parts of Khan Yunis, which the UN says are estimated to house about 500,000 residents and displaced people, because, of course, in the early stages of the war, people living in the north of the Gaza Strip were told to relocate to the south for their safety. It's also where the two big hospitals, Al-Nasser Hospital and Al-Amal Hospital, are based. That's where there are a lot of displaced people. At Al-Nasser Hospital, that's still really been the main functioning hospital in the south of the Gaza Strip. So a lot of concern about what this means. A lot of criticism, too, from Palestinian leaders in the West Bank, from the office of President Abbas. He has said that these are dangerous demands by Israel for so many people to be told to leave and head south. Of course, you know, the concern for Palestinians having so many people on the border is that there could be a plan to displace them further. What Palestinians see is a return of what happened in 1948, that their Nakba or catastrophe with hundreds of thousands of people displaced by force. And, you know, President Abbas's office said that that did seem to be Israel's intent to displace Palestinian people. So these kind of conversations at the moment making people that much more panicked. And, you know, the videos you can see from Khan Yunis show heavy gunfire and intense fighting there.
Can I just talk to you about the beginning of the end, perhaps? I mean, I think we're 3.5 months into this war now. The IDF moving from the north down to the south. They're now saying they've encircled Khan Yunis. They believe, I think, maybe some of the senior Hamas leadership is there. I mean, is this the beginning of what could be the end of the military campaign? Or, frankly, are we weeks and weeks, in your assessment, away from that?
I mean, the length of the military campaign is something that's sort of still disputable. But certainly what we can say is that there are very serious talks now going on through Qatari and Egyptian mediators with US involvement, trying to work towards a new hostage release deal that would involve a new ceasefire. The BBC has been hearing from a senior Palestinian official familiar with these talks that are going on in Egypt at the moment, where we understand a Hamas delegation was given a new proposal to stop the war consisting of 5 stages. We're told the main obstacle is Israel's insistence on keeping its forces in the Gaza Strip throughout these stages and only withdrawing them at the end. That's something Hamas has been rejecting.
Yolande Nil reporting from Jerusalem. Thailand's laws, which protect the country's monarchy from insults and criticism, have been increasingly enforced in the last decade since the military took power in a coup. The man who wants to change that was today cleared of charges of violating election laws by the country's constitutional court. Pita Limjaroenrat will keep his seat just months after the Senate prevented his Move Forward party from forming the government. I asked our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head if the ruling could mean that Mr. Pita returns to frontline politics.
It does for the moment. What hung on this case, it was about him owning shares in a media company, which is not allowed under Thai law if you're contesting an election. But this media company had been defunct. They were handed down to him by his father and a very small block of shares. And his argument that that meant he hadn't really violated the law was actually accepted by the Constitutional Court judges. It surprised quite a lot of people, because the Constitutional Court in Thailand, which has the most enormous powers to dissolve parties, ban politicians, it's even unseated prime ministers, has always ruled against reformist figures in the past. Its track record is very strongly that way. This time the judges accepted the argument and said, well, yes, as this company clearly hadn't functioned for such a long time, they didn't consider him to have violated election law. So he was suspended 6 months ago. He can now go back, take up his seat in Parliament and carry on leading his party Move Forward, which is, as you say now, the main opposition, as it was not allowed to form a government. But his party does face another legal challenge in the same court next week. And that is a much more serious accusation that their proposal to amend the Royal Defamation Law, this severe lèse majesty law, they want it to be much less harsh. The criticism of it is that by Conservatives is that this amounts to an attempt to overthrow the entire established political order. And if the Constitutional Court rules that, in fact, the party has behaved unconstitutionally by proposing changes to that law, then the party is very likely to be dissolved and it's possible its top leadership banned from politics.
And I'm going to ask you about the lèse majesté law in a minute, but just quickly, do you think this is a significant change in sentiment from the Constitutional Court?
No, I think it's tactical. It's not clear to us why they ruled the way they did. They could have gone either way. It's always presumed in Thailand, when it's never official, that the Constitutional Court is swayed by big political powers in Thailand that are outside Parliament. We're talking at the very top of the country, military monarchy. There's a whole nexus up there that's very influential. And the court has always ruled in the way that the interests of that group in the past. What the considerations were in this particular verdict, we're not sure.
But Mr. Pitta's party's attempts, as you say, to liberalise maybe those laws that protect Thailand's royal family. I mean, is there a sense that they could have any success in that, or is that going to be a far, far tougher challenge?
It'll be interesting to see what the verdict is next week, because that will send a clear signal. I think the signal that was sent, because the same justification was given for blocking him from being prime minister. The Senate said anyone who wants to change this law, you cannot touch the monarchy in any way at all. That means you can't be prime minister. So that's the prevailing view. And I think the official view is there cannot be a discussion about this law. It's widely criticised. It has horribly harsh sentences for often quite mild criticisms. But right now they're saying the discussion must be ruled out. And I think that will influence the verdict next week.
Jonathan Head, who's in Bangkok. Still to come on this edition of the Global News Podcast.
It's very useful and important to find where these sites are, because as penguins move in response to changing ice conditions, they'll probably go to existing colonies. So to know where they all are is vital.
We're going to tell you about new evidence that the emperor penguins of Antarctica are adapting to climate change and melting ice by moving home.
This is the story of a powerful Nigerian televangelist.
He was a huge celebrity and he had a way of presenting himself as man of God.
Who attracted followers to his church from around the globe.
It was like going to heaven and being asked to stay.
But once there, some say that TB Joshua used his power to control, manipulate and abuse. This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 2, The Discipled.
We all thought we were in heaven. But we were in hell, and in hell, terrible things happen.
Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, it's been just a month since President Javier Milei took office in Argentina, but large protests are expected soon over his radical plans to shake up the country's economy. As we record this podcast, tens of thousands of people are likely to take to the streets of Buenos Aires in a general strike. Trade union leaders accuse President Milei of breaking the social contract. They're against his prescription to tackle crippling inflation, part of which has seen energy and transport subsidies slashed. People like Oriana say they're finding it hard to survive.
Every day we think about whether we're going to be able to pay the rent, whether we're going to be able to pay the building service charge, the bills. To that we have to add the food bill, transportation costs. It's very difficult and you're constantly asking yourself, am I going to make ends meet? What can I cook that today is not the same as yesterday, since everything is expensive? You're constantly worried.
That was Oriana explaining some of the challenges that she faces. Well, President Milei wants new laws to slash public spending, privatise state enterprises and scrap hundreds of what he says are wasteful regulations. Our reporter Vanessa Buschlutter, who's in Buenos Aires, told us more about the plans.
Just 45 days after Mr. Milei took office, it looks like his honeymoon period is already over, if there ever was one. The biggest union, the CGT, which has 7 million members, has called for this strike, and it is expected to be joined by other unions and groups opposed to the president. And the unions say that they think they'll be able to mobilise 200,000 people.
Now, can I ask you the extent to which the trade union movement in Argentina represents a serious block to Javier Milei's ability to introduce these reforms? I mean, can they actually really impede his ability to bring about those changes?
They can. The trade unions in Argentina are very well organized. So when they call for a general strike like they're doing now, they have the possibility of really paralyzing the country. It looks like there won't be very many flights flying into Buenos Aires. Often the roads are blocked, thereby impeding transport. And they can really challenge the president also on the legal front. They already managed to bring or to challenge one of his decrees in court, and that decree has now been suspended. So they're doing a two-pronged attack there, on the streets and also in the courts.
And just finally, Vanessa, the problems are a long list, but what are the most striking problems that Argentina's economy now faces?
I think the problem that most people face is poverty. 40% or just over 40% of Argentines are now living in poverty, and they're facing huge problems with inflation. Inflation is above 200%, and it actually rose since Mr. Milei came to power. And that, of course, affects many, many people.
Well, that is Argentina. Let's go to Germany now, where there is also tension in industrial relations, because the government has condemned train drivers who are again going on strike, with the country's transport minister calling them destructive and unreasonable. Economists have warned the industrial action could cost the country more than $1 billion. Paul Moss explains.
It really is the last thing the German government needs. This month has already seen transport disrupted by angry farmers blocking roads and hauliers joining their protest over fuel tax and regulation. Now train drivers have walked out again in what's become the longest industrial dispute on the railways that Germany's ever seen. Throw in disruption to shipping in the Red Sea because of attacks by the Houthis, and Germany's export-dependent economy is left looking vulnerable. But the train drivers want a pay rise and to work fewer hours, and they currently show no sign of giving in.
A massive explosion in Mongolia's capital, caused by a fuel truck colliding with another vehicle, has killed six people. Buildings that were nearby caught fire as well. Will Leonardo has the details.
This nighttime blast in the Mongolian capital Ulaanbaatar appeared to have begun with a smaller fire immediately after the vehicles collided, before a nearby resident caught the moment the truck carrying 60 tons of gas exploded, causing a huge fireball to rip along the street. Three firefighters trying to put out the original blaze were among the six people killed. Several others were injured. Mongolian officials said 600 emergency service workers were deployed to douse fires taking hold of adjacent buildings.
We're getting close to the end of the Global News podcast now, but let's look at this first. Scientists believe they may have tracked down the last unidentified emperor penguin colonies in the Antarctic. The previously unknown nesting sites were spotted by satellite, and it brings the total number to 66. Emperor penguins are considered acutely vulnerable to climate change. Dr. Peter Fretwell from the British Antarctic Survey explains how they were found.
In the satellites, we are looking around Antarctica, looking at the ice changes and how the emperor penguin colonies that we do know are moving in response to climate change. And whilst we've been doing this, we've spotted these four previously undiscovered colonies. It's very useful and important to find where these sites are, because as penguins move in response to changing ice conditions, they'll probably go to existing colonies. So to know where they all are is vital to track their movements.
So to get a bit more on the threats faced by the penguins, but also how they're adapting, here's our science correspondent, Jonathan Amos.
We have seen in recent years, in particular, very variable ice conditions, sea ice conditions in the Antarctic. The last couple of years, particularly around summertime, towards the end of their breeding season, we've seen record lows in the satellite era. These birds, they nest on the ice for about 9 months. So they come onto the ice, they court, they mate, they lay their eggs, they brood, they go off and forage for food to bring back to the chicks. And they need that sea ice to stay there while the young birds sort of, you know, get their sort of slick, oily feathers to get ready to go into the water. And if that ice breaks up too quickly, then the young birds will go into the water and they'll drown or they'll freeze to death. And we've seen that happen a few times in recent years. You go back to 2016, thousands of young birds died very close to the British Halley base in the eastern Weddell Sea when the ice broke up underneath them.
So the penguins know about this and they adapt, they move, they simply find a new place to nest and a new place to live, do they? And the scientists are able to see this by satellite imagery from above.
Yeah, the birds tend to live in distinct groupings that have spacings of about 250 kilometres, about 150 miles. And over the years, they've been looking to try and piece together that pearl necklace of colonies around the edge of Antarctica. And probably with these four, we've got the last of the significant nesting sites in the continent. It's unlikely that we will find another very significant colony. So this brings the global population to around about 550,000 individual birds, and we'll see how they cope in the coming years. There is one projection which says this species could be quasi-extinct or extinct to, you know, just a few birds or whatever by the end of the century, if, as we expect, the ice around Antarctica to diminish in an ever-warming world.
Jonathan Amos. Now let's end on the Palestinian football team, because it's made history, winning its first ever game at the Asian Cup. They beat Hong Kong 3-0 on Tuesday, and the win in Qatar means they're through to the last 16 knockout round. In the midst of the ongoing Israel-Hamas war in Gaza, it was an emotional moment for many of the players. Here's Yasser Hamed speaking after the game.
For us, this is amazing. You know, now the situation, the environment in the dressing room, it's amazing because we make history. You know, for the national team, for all Palestinian people who is suffering. So this is all the team is happy, and I think we made happy also for millions of Palestinians around the world.
Well, for a bit more on what it felt like and what the game was actually like as well, I spoke to journalist Sam Kunte, who was at the match.
Yeah, it was a very powerful moment here at the Asian Cup when Palestine qualified with a thumping win against Hong Kong. And you sense that these Palestinian matches are something else, in a sense that they are emotionally draining. You can sense the pressure on the players. You can sense the emotions around the team and the emotions with the fans in the stands. And there is, of course, a high degree of symbolism here, because this is a Palestinian entity representing Palestinians and the diaspora around the world on a major stage. This is not the West Bank or Gaza. This is a Palestinian team at the continental finals.
What's the quality of the football like, though, in terms of the game between the Palestinian team and Hong Kong?
Well, Hong Kong played two rather good matches against Iran and the United Arab Emirates. Remember, Hong Kong are the lowest ranked team in the tournament. It felt yesterday that they had kind of run out of energy and steam, and they couldn't apply the same intensity.
Now, I'm just reading that Palestine's captain Moussa Belbatat reckons that this demonstrates his team is among the best in the continent. Do you think that's true?
Well, perhaps that is an overstatement in the sense that, you know, Palestine obviously can't compete with the major traditional continental heavyweights. But there is a sense that the team has grown. 4 years ago, they didn't make it out of the group stages and they played very, you know, defensive football. They're playing more expensive football.
And just quickly, I mean, so what hopes now for the last 16? Are they going to progress, or frankly, just to get this far is enough?
Yeah, I think that you could sense among the players that there was a sense of relief. They're no longer under pressure. They have delivered, and this tournament is already a success. They are likely to play Australia or Qatar in the round of 16, and that might perhaps be a step too far, but it's a miracle that they've gotten this far, and it's a major achievement. So from their point of view, the tournament has already been a success.
Sam Kunte, who watched that game at the Asian Cup in Qatar. Right, that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics that we cover in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Derek Clark. The producer was Stephanie Tillotson. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until the next time, thanks for listening and goodbye.